ebooks.
So in essence, the Byzantines having this sort of capacity for gathering intelligence,
yeah,
and almost having like a predecessor to, like, is it MI6 as the foreign one
in Britain? Yeah. MI6,
you know,
yeah.
Or like, you know, CIA, whatever, gathering intelligence and learning about all these people, some who are closer to the periphery of empire and some that are distant. For instance, it covers a number of steppe tribes that are sort of like long lost to memory. I mean, really, to some degree, even like the Pechenegs went extinct after the two battles they fought against Alexios and John Comnenus. We know about the Pechenegs because of them existing in Dead Imperio Administrando. So this is really, you might say, the first case of like an official sense, as a matter of government policy. As I'd mentioned before, the process sort of begins towards the end of, you know, when you sort of have that east-west split under Theodosius, you know, with Arcadius and the Eastern emperors, that the Byzantines cultivate and refine this mechanism which assists them, you know, both in a diplomatic context and also in a military context. They sort of learn how to fight against different enemies, and they sort of gather intelligence as to what their enemies might be, what their strengths are. There's an example whereby I got a feeling it was against the Bulgars, and I can't remember if they invite the Cumans or the Pechenegs, whoever it was, and they got too powerful, so they invited the Kievan Rus to sort of like counter-invade them, because like, oh, we can't have one enemy that's too powerful on the Danubian frontier, you know, and Byzantine history to this point is quite, replete with these examples. Often even like the Eastern campaigns, and I suppose we'll get to the resurgence in the East in a bit, but for instance, the emir of Aleppo or Homs would be a paid up tributary of the Byzantine Empire rather than to the Caliphate in Baghdad or in Egypt.
Mm.
But you're going to make the point about the Kievan Rus earlier, if you might remember where you're going to go with that.
Well, it's just a whole massive story, isn't it? It's a whole massive element to the Byzantine story. It's so big that, you know, whole books are written about it. Whole PhDs will be written about it.
Mm. I think what's important, or what's worth mentioning, is that, you know, sadly it's sort of overshadowed by the present situation in the Donbass, you know, being 2025 and all.
Mm.
But that the establishment of the... Because actually, in many ways, this is the beginning of the Varangian Guard. You know, well, it's... It'll be further forward, but under the reign of John Zamiskis, the failed raid on Constantinople by the Kievan Rus, and then he marries off his sister or his daughter, I can't remember, to the Prince of Kiev, and then in succession, you have Olga and these other leaders of Kiev who sort of embrace Orthodoxy, and what you actually have is the genesis of what we sort of understand as modern Orthodox Russia.
Mm.
And you have another example of that at the very end of the empire, where Sophia Palaiologos is the niece of Constantine, the last Constantine of the empire. Therefore another sort of another influx of royal Byzantine blood into these sort of Russian aristocratic lines, and so it creates this sort of kinship between Greeks and Russians, and it sort of acts as the basis of how the Russians have this sort of self-identification between themselves, their civilization, and their Orthodox religiosity. It has its basis with its interactions with East Rome, with the Byzantines.
Mm. Yeah. God, there's so much to say. Whenever you try and condense down centuries worth of history, you can only ever do it at sort of low resolution, right?
Yeah.
You can only ever
hit the highlights. Yeah.
So like, I don't know, if we haven't really got time to go into sort of the whole Kievan Rus thing and the Varangian Guard and all the ins and outs of that. I mean, one or two episodes could be an hour and a half long episode of epochs on it.
Frankly, the entire duration of this discussion could actually in itself be like a miniseries. It really could.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think a few months ago, AM and I did a discussion on the Cum Ninoi, and it was like a 3.5 hour stream on one period, which I mean, we're going to canvas it, but we'll have to just do it briefly. But it's very easy to do that once you start going to sort of depth and resolution, as you say.
Okay, so you mentioned before the period of iconoclasm.
Yes.
If you want to say a few words about that, how that all played out.
Well, there were people who will know more about it than myself. So it's probably hard for me to sort of cast, you know, a lot of light onto that. My expertise in history is sort of like elsewhere. You know, it's more, you know, linguistics and warfare and, you know, the bureaucracy and like the state and all that, you know. So religion is probably less of a forte for me in that sense. But it is intriguing that the Byzantines stumble into this sort of period of iconoclasm, whereby up until this point, and even after iconoclasm, and it's a hallmark, certainly of Catholic and of Orthodox Christianity. I know in Protestantism there's a slightly different priest, you know, a slightly different interpretation of like icons and statues and whatever. And as we know, the Muslims are very much against the representation of religious figures in their religion. But they were so sort of beset and were probably rightly concerned that the world as they knew it was coming to an end, you know, when the Arabs are brushing aside Roman armies from, you know, Syria to Tunisia. And they're knocking on the doors of the Taurus Mountains, and they, you know, literally around the walls of Constantinople, you know, like, are the Byzantines thinking, you know, have we forsaken our God? Have we done something wrong? You know, are we being punished for our sins? You know, a bit like that, the comment used with Genghis Khan, it's like, you know, God has brought me here to punish me for your sins. You know, it's, I am the, you know, I'm the scourge of God, as it were. And that coincides with the iconoclastic period and the Byzantines having this belief that, you know, maybe with this representation of icons, we have, you know, sinned gravely. And it ended up being an internal ideological dispute for the better part of a century. And it was only kind of reversed towards the end of the Phrygian dynasty, of which, like I said to you, I've mentioned Michael the Drunkard. And it's kind of a bit of an unfair epithet, but he was probably the real last fervent iconoclast emperor.
Well, they're smashing the faces off all their
images and mosaics, and sort of defacing statues.
Very much like hardline Protestants did during the Reformation.
Very much so.
It's just that was wrong, so we're going to smash it.
Yeah.
We're just going to rip it down, rip it out, get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair comparison. What I would say is that I think there's a distinction between, I think the Protestants were more concerned, and I mean, I'm not an Englishman, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Protestants are more concerned with the internal management of the realm and this internal contest of Catholicism and Protestantism within England. Whereas I think the Byzantines were like, we are beset by an outside force that is going to overwhelm us.
Right.
And we wish to achieve some kind of salvation lest we lose our country. Oh,
no, fair point. If the net result is the images of people get their faces ripped off or ripped down or their nose broken off or something, if the net result is very, very similar, the motivations are very dissimilar. Yeah.
Correct.
And the way it happened, it played out in Germany or in France during the French Revolution, say, or how it played out in Britain during like the 17th century or something. They're all very different. They've all sort of got their own story. So, yeah, although there are massive parallels there, they're also very different things.
Different means and motivations, but similar outcomes and similar desire, you might say.
Yeah. So, okay, let's talk about the Great Schism then. We must a bit about sort of Irene.
Yeah, well, maybe just before that, I was going to say, because there's a period between the end of the Phrygian dynasty, which is sort of the beginning of the, you might say, the resurgence period. Because what you have is the emergence of a number of these sort of landed aristocratic families, magnates, as they're often called. Dynatoi, to use the Greek word. The Phocoi, they're a famous example because, I mean, Nikephoros Phokas becomes an emperor. You have John Zimisces, you have the Korkouas family. John Korkouas, for instance, was probably one of the most successful generals in this period. Again, unless you're like a Byzantist, you don't really come across him. But these are the men who, you know, very famously lead to the victory of Katakalon, which is in sort of eastern Anatolia. It's one of the real successes they have against the caliphate. They absolutely destroy an Arab army. because right at the end of the Phrygian dynasty, actually, the Arabs do sack Amorion, which at this point is like the second capital of the empire, because that's where the Phrygian dynasty is from. Amoria, or Amorion, the city, is in Phrygia, which is sort of, I'm just trying to help people here, west of modern-day Ankara. If you sort of drove south directly from Istanbul, you'd eventually hit it, more or less. Like, it's in that western half of, or the western third of Anatolia. Amorion was a very, very wealthy city and a very powerful city, sort of not too far from Dorylaeon or something like that, or Gordion. But it was a very, very, very powerful city this time, and the Arabs sack it. And after you have the emergence of the Macedonian dynasty and these magnates and generals who end up rising, permeating to the top of Byzantine society, engage in these eastern campaigns, and it actually almost gets to the point where they're almost annual. They recapture Melitene, which is one of the biggest successes they have at this time period. And the capture of Melitene sent shockwaves to the Arab world, because it's the first time they've actually genuinely suffered a reversal whereby a foreign power has retaken a city that Islam has captured. It's actually a seismic event. It, in some ways, is in the same way that Tours Poitiers is important to us in the West, in Latin West. The recapture of Melitene is an equivalent example in the East, and in some ways actually more important, because it's not just a battle, a victorious battle, it's the recapturing of a city. Mm. It's the first one that Islam loses to Christianity in a reconquest context.
Right. And when is that, roughly, do you know?
Oh, gosh, I'm trying to jig my memory now.
I'm
thinking like 910, 920.
Right,
sorry if I get dragged through the comments, but
that's the sort of...
It's like early 900s.
That's the sort of time I was thinking, which is to say...
And the sack of Amorion is like 880s or something like that.
Which is to say quite a long time after Arab conquest.
They're reeling for 2.5 centuries, practically.
That's the point
They fight off the siege and they hold the frontiers. But it's a long time until they actually go back on the counterattack in a fairly comprehensive manner.
A couple of centuries. Oh. We're just not used, in the modern world, postmodern world, we're just not used to those sorts of time frames on things, are we?
Yeah. Well, think of this, right? So America's about to turn like 250 years old, thereabouts, right? The time in which the Byzantines reverse the Arab conquest and recapture a city from Islam is the lifespan of the American nation.
Yeah.
Like, imagine that.
Yeah.
That's fairly comprehensive. It's, you know, and this is the thing, is like, you know, we have to, you know, think in similar time spans, because, you know, this is how civilizations are. Like, they don't just crop up every 5 minutes and vanish in 10 minutes. Like, you know, civilizations are a complicated thing. And the fate of nations is something that doesn't, I mean, calamities can be suffered overnight, granted, but, you know, say in the case of the Byzantines, you've got to think, you know, from the moment that, you know, you got to think, Yarmouk is 636, Constantinople's 1453. There's a long time between, you know, so you're almost looking at, you know, 1,000 years, 800 years. It's a long time, you know.
So with the Great Schism, then, there's this period where there's no male emperor in Rome.
Yeah, because you have two princesses of the Macedonian dynasty, Theodora and Irene.
Irene,
yes.
And so, I mean, people
who were descended from Basil the Boguslayer, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
And people, scholars, historians, argue about the sort of the details and various motivations of various people. But some have said, I don't know if you agree with this, that there's something in the Western Christian mind, or it's something in the Pope at the time that sees this as an excuse or a reason or an opportunity to say we don't recognize or we can't recognize a female empress, and therefore we're not going to recognize. We're not going to recognize your empire or your religion anymore. We're not going to recognize, your version,
or the primacy of the patriarch. For
example. Yeah, we don't recognize your version of Christianity, like formally saying, we're formally not recognizing it from now. Go, and so we are now the real church, the Catholic Church. We're the real ones, and you can call yourself whatever you want. But we're different things now.
Yeah.
The full spiritual authority is in Rome. And you tried to usurp it for a few centuries there, but you failed, and now and now we split. It's a full schism.
Yeah.
Or some people say schism. I say schism.
I prefer schism.
Yeah, I think it's schism.
Yeah, schism. That's not really a word. Yeah, schism. Yeah, it's schism sounds so much like incision. Like it's,
Anyway. You're trying to say the word scissors and didn't finish.
Yeah, exactly.
Schism.
Schism. Yeah. Well, this sort of has a little bit of a bit of a backstory and precedence with the crowning of Charlemagne.
Okay.
When he is making...
Which is that? Is that 800?
Yeah.
It's bang on 800, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
And it's around, I'm trying to think, it's around Christmas or New Year or something. Like
it, yeah, it's Christmas Day or New Year's Day? I always forget that detail.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like, it's an important part of the calendar, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's New Year's Day or New Year's Eve, I think it was.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
anyway.
And there's always that what if scenario that had he married the empress at the time, you would have had a unification of the, you know, the Frankish kingdom and the East Roman Empire, which would have been quite a tantalizing prospect. However, that didn't occur. And see, what you have here is this sort of coincides with the absolute erosion of Byzantine authority in the Italian peninsula. And we sort of touched on the defeats that the Byzantines were suffering at that time and them just trying to survive the Arab onslaught. And so the Pope, with the degree of legitimacy in this context, felt that the Byzantines could no longer ensure the protection of Rome and the safeguardianship of, you know, what we understand to be the Vatican City today, but of, you know, St. Peter's Basilica and the head of the church. And the most logical option for the Pope in that sense was obviously Charlemagne. I mean, Charlemagne, by this point in time, had accumulated a lot of power in Francia.
Oh, God, yeah, he was the most powerful man in Europe by easily, by a long, long way.
And the kingdom of Charlemagne was a very powerful and a very unified and strong entity.
Yeah.
And you got to think it's like two or three generations removed from Charles Martel. Charles Martel was his grandfather, right?
Yes.
You know, from Poitiers, where, you know, the Franks, you know, dismounted from their horses and made a stand against the Arabs in southern France, to, you know, you're talking about a kingdom that spans from Brittany to the border of modern-day Hungary down to... from central Italy, like almost up to Denmark. It's a very powerful kingdom, a very strong kingdom. And Charlemagne is also engaging in something of a, like a mini renaissance in the Frankish kingdom. You know, monastic scholarship is, you know, coming to the fore once again. Frankish armies are very strong. They're building, you know, new towns and cities, and trade's flourishing. You know, Europe hasn't seen this kind of stability since Roman times. Well, I mean, not to its full extent, but something resembling it.
Charlemagne doesn't return to those high watermarks, but it's the closest thing they've had.
If you lived within Francia, for a long time, it's the most sort of peace that you've had. You know, I mean, not that the same person would be alive three centuries prior, but it's the most prosperity that any of those people would have, you know, lived under. And also, as well, is that the Frankish kingdom, if you sort of look into the real nitty gritty history of the Franks, they're the Germanic tribe who adopt the most Roman sort of features, I suppose. They're the most Romanized of the Germanics, and that also it transpons in their language. Like, the reason why French is a Romance language but with German affectations is because of that essentially an ethnogenesis that occurs in Gaul. You know, the Franks are this sort of melding of the Germanic and the Gallo-Roman, and so, you know, for the Pope there's a strong degree of familiarity with them, which they find far more truly European or true to the Latin heart of Rome itself than with the Greek Eastern Constantinople.
Well, if the Holy Roman Emperor, Charlemagne himself, Karl der Grosse, if they were going to reimagine and sort of resurrect the idea of having a Roman emperor, there's absolutely no question it's going to be Charlemagne.
He's certainly the closest.
There's just no question. It's obviously him.
He's by far the closest
example. It's obviously him. In fact, it couldn't be anyone else. Yes. They only resurrect it because Charlemagne exists.
Yes.
Because he's already done it.
In his form as he was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
obviously you have that precedent to cleave back to the original question.
Yeah.
There's this precedent already where the Pope doesn't acknowledge the authority of Constantinople.
Yeah.
Certainly from let's call it like an imperial secular sense.
We're now in the 11th century again, we're talking. We've just jumped ahead.
Yeah, so we go back to the 11th century, right? Yeah. So this is sort of the argument between the Pope and by the Patriarch, Michael Kyrillatios. is a dispute of actual authority. And so you have this situation whereby the Patriarch and the Pope excommunicate one another. And there's a sort of series of furious letters sent back and forth.
Yeah.
Because what's sort of interesting is that the Byzantines have this really strange example, and in my opinion, a more fitting and effective example of where the Patriarch and the Emperor do quite a good job of coexisting with each other. Whereas...
In the East, Constantinople.
The Patriarch and the Emperors of Constantinople,
for
the most part, coexist fairly well, and mostly to the benefit of, you know, the empire and its subjects. Whereas what we sort of see is from this point onwards and into the medieval period, this idea that the Pope would have, you know, religious and spiritual dominion over everybody in the West, including the aristocracy and kings of Europe, if you get what I mean.
Mm.
Sort of in Byzantium, they sort of sit like this, whereas in the West, you have like the Pope and then all the monarchies underneath. So there's sort of a bit of a power play, a cynicism towards papal power play that one has to kind of acknowledge.
Mm.
Religious and doctrinal questions notwithstanding.
Mm.
But the sad thing is, a bit like Yarmouk in a sort of military context, the Great Schism has immense political and civilizational, you know, repercussions survive to our day. You know, the Greek Church and the Pope are still technically not in communication with one another.
Yeah.
I mean, they engage in dialogue, but I mean, the two churches are still in technical dispute with each other.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know,
I mean, they will meet, like, occasionally. Yeah. Like, there's modern photographs of the Patriarch and the Pope standing next to each other.
And it's quite cordial.
It's quite cordial, but, yeah, we don't agree on what God thinks and wants and what heaven is like.
Correct.
And all sorts of things.
And also, too, is that, and maybe I do have a bit of a Byzantine bias, despite the fact I'm Catholic, is that there was a Pentarchy, you know, and there are five heads of each church. There's Rome and Constantinople and Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria. But the Pope in Rome feels as if his position is above the Pentarchy, whereas even though the Patriarch within the Empire, and you got to think, there was a time where all five of those churches existed under the Byzantine East Roman sphere, under its dominion, the Patriarch never was sort of above them as such.
Mm.
He was only maybe technically above them in a judicial sense because of his proximity to the Emperor.
Mm.
But, you know, the Pope in Constantinople was technically no more powerful than the Pope in the representative of Antioch or of Alexandria. The Patriarch is what I meant to say. Whereas the Pope in Rome has fashioned himself into something else.
Hmm.
And, you know, if you want to go into the whole, like, thing, again, it could be like a whole other stream, but the idea that in some ways Peter, as in the original St. Peter, you know, fashions himself as Pontifex Maximus, which is, obviously, we know, a Roman pagan. Position.
Absolutely, yeah.
And those two become melded into what we understand as the Pope in Rome, and that's its own thing, because the equivalent Patriarch in Alexandria or Jerusalem or Constantinople doesn't do that. So
I still find it interesting that
there's a whole can of worms there. I wish our esteemed friend was here, because I think Mr. Majesty would have a better take on that from a religious standpoint. But
even the Pope today is sometimes called the Pontiff or the Chief Pontiff.
Correct,
or something.
Yeah, it's like, well, any inscriptions like, you know, Pont Max.
Yeah.
Pontifex Maximus.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. We hope you enjoyed that video. And if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.